You're listening to Dairy Voice by Dairy Business News, a podcast exclusively for the dairy industry.
One of our sponsors of the Dairy Voice podcast is National DHIA. NDHIA ensures information accuracy and represents their members' interests. They are the direct voice for the dairy information industry. To find out more, go to dhia.org.
Dairy One's Soil Laboratory provides a variety of industries with soil testing and analysis. For most of our customers, their businesses literally start from the ground up. A soil analysis will help our customers ensure that the right nutrients are available in the soil or if additional fertilizers are needed. These decisions will impact their plant growth and yield. If you need to improve your soil's health, Dairy One is ready to help. Contact the Dairy One Soil Laboratory by emailing soil@dairyone.com. That's dairyone.com. So we're back with part two of silage harvest planning. Again, my guest is Eric Doerr of Stillwater Animal Technologies. If you haven't listened to part one, I suggest you do that, or listen to part two first and then listen to part one. Either way, I think you're going to find that you're going to learn a whole bunch about silage harvest planning that you may never knew before. So here we go. Well, let's talk about something that's near and dear to our hearts, both of us, inoculants and sealing. So how do we prepare? I mean, there's different inoculants out there on the market. They do different things. How do you prepare and plan for which kind of inoculant you're going to use and how you're going to take care of it and who's going to be in charge of mixing and all that kind of thing?
I think following the manufacturer suggested, how do you treat the products, right? As far as storage, as far as mixing, I think all the major manufacturers have good information on that. They're all pretty consistent there as well. Some want frozen, some want refrigerated, some have shelf stable, but follow the manufacturer's recommendations is probably the best recommendation, right? Thoroughly mixing these products is difficult. You got to realize, you know, what an inoculant is. It's a massive amount of bacteria in a small package. And that bacteria is, you know, it's kind of in this, we call it freeze-dried or lyophilized, but it's in this suspended state of animation. Mm-hmm. And until we rehydrate it, which is what we're trying to do when we mix these things with water, then once that's done, then you have a massive amount of life, if you will, going on there. So we need to protect it with temperature. And most of the major manufacturers would recommend keeping it, that water mixture, under 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Which means I need to have an applicator that allows me to do that.
Right.
And not all of them do. Some of the built on board applicators that come from our good friends in the harvesting industry don't understand that. And actually, you put a black tank in the sun or put a black tank next to 900 horsepower and see what happens.
Right.
Yeah, it can get hot. Now, they can also work too. So maybe we're going through enough volume and we're getting that out of there fast enough before it has a chance to heat. All those things are factors, but certainly worth checking.
Transform dairy data from numbers into valuable decision-making information with HERDHQ, the ultimate web-based platform brought to you by DRMS. Leverage advanced analytics, benchmarking, and alert systems to optimize productivity, minimize costs, and improve herd health. If you're part of the Beef on Dairy movement, check out Keeper Beef. Love your iPhone or iPad? CalCompass will provide you with extensive animal and herd information, no matter what type of device you use. Do you like charts and graphs? Check out Dairy Depot, with over 100 charts and tables. HERDHQ is available to all herds that process their DHI data with DRMS. Don't miss out on this game-changing dairy management solution. Contact DRMS today to schedule a demo.
But if you're going that fast, though, Eric, how fast are you delivering that product to the pile in order to push it up? That's not a question. So
there's all those things. You started out talking about product selection. How do you make those decisions? Right. And I've kind of changed my thought on this, and I like it, so I'll use it. And it's just like, well, understand what's the risk on that particular crop. It doesn't matter what it is, but like, what is most likely my risk on that particular crop? I'll give you an example. I was on Victoria Island, British Columbia, a few years ago, and it was a farm, and the person was not happy with the results that he got out there. And what I'm getting at is they make a lot of wet grass silage. You can imagine they get a lot of rain on this
Sure.
island off the coast, right? And the people sold him something for what they thought, and I'm air quoting, wet feeds, which was for Clostridia for grass, right? He didn't have that problem. They never asked him about that. For whatever reason, in his area, it doesn't matter how wet he puts it up, they don't see a lot of butyric acid production. They don't see a lot of Clostridia. So he didn't ask the right questions. Like, if they'd asked him, like, what's your risk? He'd have told them, my risk is when it's sitting here in my pile and on my face, it gets hot and moldy. Well, that's a completely different situation. So I think it's understanding the risk factors for the crops on your farm, how you manage them, what are you going to do with them? Like, if I'm moving a feed, right? We move a lot of feeds, particularly up here on these really big farms, or like you mentioned, maybe we put a pile on the corner of a circle, right? It's out there in the field, but we're going to have to move that. Well, anytime we move a feed, we know we're exposing it to a tremendous amount of oxygen. I would never not consider, not in a million years would I not consider using, a product that didn't give me maximum aerobic stability for that, because I know I'm going to be faced with that challenge. Right. So it's kind of the way I look at it is understanding what the risks are for that particular crop. And they might, it might not even be that crop. It might be this crop in this season under this condition. Maybe I put up wet, again, wet triticale. I'm putting in a drive-over pile that's out in the field versus putting it in a bunker this year that happened to be normally dedicated to this feed, but I could put it there this year. Right. So it just because I, well, that's the way we always do it. We might not always do it that way. We might move the feed. And so that might, cause us to make a different decision. And then, understanding what those risks are, it's like, well, then I need to kind of look at more of a multi-trait selection, if you will. So like we're going to choose semen for breeding. Are we just choosing for maximum milk production? Of course not. We got to have good feet. We got to have good udders. We got to have, longevity. We got to have health, and we got to have a lot of factors. So we're looking at multiple traits when we're trying to select for a bull that we're going to mate a cow with, right? Well, why is that no different in silage, right? So I want a feed that's cold, that's fresh, that's stable, that's free of yeast, it's free of mold, things like that. Like those would be my criteria. Well, then I need to choose a product that helps me get that. And not all of them do. I absolutely will tell you, there's a lot of them don't. They'll drop the pH. There's a lot of products that drop the pH, but that doesn't necessarily, I say pH smH. That doesn't mean that I've maximized my control on yeast and molds. That certainly doesn't mean that I've maximized my aerobic stability. And if they can't provide or show aerobic stability, and what we're talking about is like we have that pit pile bag bunker, we've opened it up, that face is exposed to oxygen. And a lot of times we remove a big, truckload or several buckets of it, we move it over to a feed center, right? How long is it going to be before that feed that's cool coming out of that silo before it wants to reheat? Because it will reheat eventually. And that's what we call that a measure of aerobic stability. And scientifically, we'd look at that as like, about 5 Fahrenheit or 2 degrees Celsius. And of course, nobody's out there probing that on there, but 5 degrees Fahrenheit is not a much of a change, really. I mean, you go and feel it. If you can feel it and it's warm, it's probably a 10 to 20 degree Fahrenheit kind of change. Yeah. So it's like, well, what does that mean? Well, what that means is we have carbohydrates, we have calories, if you will, we have, nutrients in this feed. And we want to put that feed into the rumen of the cows and then let the microbes in the rumen digest them. And, that's the whole process of fermentation in the cow. If that's happening in an aerobic, meaning pump full of air, if you will, in front of the silo or in the feed center, that means we have spoilage organisms. That's the simplest way to think about it, but it could be yeast, molds, enterobacteria growing on this feed, and we're feeding them. And the reason we're feeling heat is they're just like me, they're respiring. And so I'm eating a carbohydrate, which is a CHO, right? I'm eating a carbohydrate or utilizing a sugar molecule in my body, a glucose molecule, and I'm producing heat, water, and CO2. I'm respiring. Well, it's the same thing these spoilage organisms are doing in your feed. So every time you do a, well, that's heat and water and CO2, which means I'm losing that out of my feed. And that's where a lot of these losses come from. It's just kind of the simplest way I know of to explain to it. Like, we want to grow bugs in the rumen. We don't want to grow bugs in the silage before we get it in the rumen. Like, pre-digestion doesn't make the feed more digestible. We're losing.
Right.
So we want that. We want those products that keep that feed cold and stable and don't want to reheat in front of us. And that technology has been around 20, 22 years, was, you know, one of the first really good products that came out. So it's not new. Now, if you haven't heard of it and you're not, you know, paying attention to it, then maybe it's new to you, but it's not new technology. It is proven and it works. And there's plenty of really good companies that provide those kinds of products. So,
right.
But there's other scenarios like that wet grass flex bunker scenario. Probably not, probably it's probably wet enough that butyric acid production due to Clostridia is what our biggest concern is.
Right.
And if we're going to feed it fast, aerobic stability is probably not our long-term feed. Say we're just going to inoculate it, get it sealed for 30 days, and then we want to feed it right away, and we're only going to feed it for 3 or 4 weeks.
Right.
Well, then I could probably get by without an aerobic stability product, but okay, what's my risk for it going clostridic?
Mm-hmm.
Is it high? Is it low? What's my experience on this farm in my situation? Yeah, if I always have butyric acid production, which means I have a clostridial infection, they dominated the fermentation. What strategies have I tried to do that to reduce that? Right. And if I haven't tried a, you know, a clostridial inhibiting type of product, well, maybe I should, but some of it may have to do with the ash content coming in. Well, that's where the organisms are coming in. So maybe I need to change my raking management or my merging management, or even something as simple as the angle of the blades on the disc mower can change how much ash we put into these wet feeds. And the wetter they are, the stickier they are. So the more the dirt sticks to them. And that's where the ash shows up in the forage analysis. So again, it's kind of, you got to look at everything. But, you know, to me, that's a whole long rambling away to say, you know, really understanding what your risks are should chase you down the road of, well, where do I need to focus on? Because I really want to eliminate risks. I've heard people say, you know, using a silage inoculant's like an insurance. No, I don't believe that, because I think you never want to use insurance, right? I hate when I got to call my insurance agent and say, I got to make a claim, right? That's not what I want to do. I said, I think the better way to think of it is think about what happens in the dairy industry. And now I'm talking the cheese or yogurt industry. You know, the yogurt plant doesn't just dump the milk into a vat that they get from these farms and go, oh, please turn it into yogurt. And it's certainly not Greek cows making Greek yogurt. You know, Chobani built a giant plant, the largest Greek yogurt plant in the world in Twin Falls, Idaho, and they didn't import any cows from Greece. They didn't. It's the cultures that they add to those, you know, to that milk to get the end result. And that's how they get a Greek yogurt different than a conventional yogurt. It's the cultures they add, or if you will, the inoculant that they add to it. But the unique thing that the, you know, yogurt plant has is they're starting with a pasteurized product. They
right.
got a clean sheet, right?
Yeah.
So they can direct it to make it do this or make it do that with the processes that they can control and which the cultures that they add to get that end result. And it's kind of what we want to do with silage, except we're not starting with pasteurized feed coming out of the field. This stuff is filthy.
Mm-hmm.
It's contaminated with dirt. It's contaminated with yeast, mold, enterobacteria, all this stuff. Oh, and maybe we even spread some manure on that crop, which is a great practice, but we got challenges. And so when we have these challenges, this is where these products need to come in and overwhelm the system with beneficial bacteria that know what they're doing, designed to solve the problems based on the risk factors that we think we're going to have. So it's not an insurance policy. It's directing us to get to an end result. If you think it's an insurance policy, you're also okay with the fact that maybe it doesn't do anything and I'm going to let Mother Nature run my fermentation. And then that gets back to the question we had a few minutes ago. It's like, well, what are our losses then? If I have some slow, have no idea what it is coming out of my fields, running my fermentation, you could have a 15 or 20% loss there, right? But it's definitely higher than one of these, you know, specially selected, fast producing organisms that, you know, generally every company in the industry has to sell. And they all tell you they have the fastest one, but that's what it's built upon, right? Is, you know, fast is going to win the race here. So those are all important factors. So.
Have you run out of silage? Had to buy expensive, marked up feed to fill the gap? Maybe production's dropped due to lower dry matter intakes. Are molds or mycotoxins creeping through your piles or bunkers? And pitching the rot is a dangerous pain. Oxygen is the enemy. Pack it out, then keep it out with Seal Pro, the professional grade silage barrier film protection chosen by top professional farmers like you. Make more, better, safer silage with Seal Pro. Learn more at sealprosilage.com.
Sealing is always the last thing you do in the harvest. By that time, you're so sick of growing and fertilizing and chopping and everything else that's going on. And you just kind of go, oh, God, do we have to seal this too?
Oh, it's everybody's favorite job.
Oh, of course. Fires and...
Yeah. And it's always, you know, perfect weather conditions and everything. Yeah. It's, yeah. The sun's always shining.
Sure.
It's always, our,
always yeah. 70 degrees. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, probably one of the most critical factors is to make sure that we get, you know, a good cover and good seal, really. I mean, we can cover piles, and I've got thousands of pictures of them. You know, Keith used to say, not all seals are effective, or what do you say? A pile may be covered, but it doesn't mean that it's effective, right?
Right, right.
You know, so just covering it as long, you know, the whole purpose in covering these piles with plastic is not to keep the rain off of them, although it does do that. That is a secondary, if, you know, and it's not to keep it from blowing away. It's to keep the oxygen from getting into it. And so, right. Again, go back to the steak example that we bought on Monday. Our best way to preserve it is to put it in a vacuum seal bag, and then we can put it in the refrigerator, and we're not going to have any losses there. Mm-hmm. In fact, it'll actually go through a lactic acid fermentation through there. It's called wet aging, but that's a whole nother story. But it's important. It's so important because the losses in the top 3 feet are humongous if we don't get it sealed up well. And we've all seen those. I mean, I've seen mushrooms. I've seen, you know. Gosh, where do mushrooms grow, right?
Right.
Yeah. So right. That's what your feed is exactly. Underneath that mushroom. Yeah. If you're growing mushrooms, that's what your feed is. So we don't have to say the word, but that's what's going on. And it's all because oxygen penetrates up there. And it's for a couple of reasons. One is we can never get it as densely packed on the top layer of that pile or that bunker, just so the physical properties. Obviously, the stuff that's on the bottom 3 feet, it's got all the weight on top of it. It's been there for, you know, that top layer is never going to be as dense just because it doesn't have something on top of it. That's always an issue. It is the wetter feet or the drier feet, the drier feet coming in, right? Because it's right. The end of the harvest. So it's not like, you know, everybody said in a perfect world, we'd have the stuff that we had on day one and we'd put a load or two of that on top. Well, yeah, that's a perfect world, but nothing's perfect. So maybe right. You start planting an extra, you know, 5 acres that you bring in very last, and it's planted a month after everything else. And it's really immature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just for a lower dry matter, higher moisture content on top. But that's pretty logistically hard to do for most people, right?
Right.
Nobody does that. You know, we have a density issue there, and then really we have a material issue. The quality of that material going on top of it will dictate our end results. You know, plastic is not plastic.
Correct.
So yeah. if it was, well, then let's just take a garbage bag and store that prime steak in it, right? We don't need to put it in a vacuum seal bag. We'll just put it in any old bag. Well, you could do that. You could put it in a Ziploc bag. I never recommended that, though. Because oxygen will still get through the material in the Ziploc bag. And it's not just because, well, I didn't get enough of it squeezed out, although that's part of it. It actually permeates through the material itself, through the plastic, because it all really has to do with the chemistry of the material itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you'll see the oxygen barrier bags, or in our case, oxygen barrier plastics, have a different feel. They have a different stretch. Mm-hmm. They are different chemistries there, and they block these, you know, they're microscopic holes that are in the plastic that O2 can pass through, right? And so it's important that we use quality materials that are designed that are truly barriers.
Mm-hmm.
To oxygen. You know, I've heard, I use vapor barrier. I can't remember last time that vapor, which is water, right, was our problem.
Right.
It's not water seeping through the plastic. Now, it can be, right, if we don't have our seams of our, you know, our sheets laid over. Everybody wants to cheat there and only have a foot. Well, that's playing with fire, right? We need, I think, a minimum of 3, and so I tell people 6 feet, so maybe they'll mm-hmm. do 4, but, mm-hmm. You know, farmer always cuts it in half, whatever you tell them, so... So you better tell them 6 feet. So you end up with 3 feet, but you know, we need a good solid overlap there, because everybody's seen it when the plastics come apart. What do we have there? Big, rotten, nasty spot. And now mm-hmm. we're just throwing that away. Well, that was originally a $50 a ton type of material. And now right. it's worth nothing.
Right.
In fact, if I get it in the ration, what do I got? Sick cows, poor NDF digestibility. I got a lot of money I'm spending with my veterinarian. I'm buying all kinds of fancy additives to bind this, or, you know, deal. Let's just have clean feet.
Right.
We know how to do it, right? And the barrier is a huge, the true oxygen barrier materials are a huge part of that. you know, getting them done right. And then when we do that and use a good barrier, you know, we're cutting that dry matter loss in the top 3 feet by a tremendous amount. I mean, the basic research would show if we don't cover, we lose about 75% mm-hmm. in the top 3 feet. And if we use mm-hmm. a conventional material, we'll lose about 50%. Mm-hmm. So this yeah. is why I know these losses are higher. You know, you started out talking about losses. It's hard to get to single digit losses when your top 3 feet has a 50% loss in it. But then if we get down to a two layer system, maybe we get a 25% loss, or if we get down to a true, really well sealed oxygen barrier type of, you know, system, we can probably get that down to 10 or so percent. And that's still the best we can do. But if we can get to there, now we have a fighting chance. Right. If our goal is to get the single digit shrink, we got to be doing all of these things along the way. We got to be, you know, reducing our aerobic stability risks. We've got to be reducing our risks of spoilage in the top 3 feet. Financially, it pays to use these products, but think about what else it does. You know, the health of the cows. If we've got stuff growing, I have dug in the top of more piles and done more samples than about anybody I know. Really looked at yeast and mold and enterobacteria in these top layers, and it is hideous. You would not eat this stuff.
No. So why should you cattle?
I mean, this stuff literally will make you sick too. And there are times where I would, you know, if you don't wash your hands, you know, later you wonder why. So then we spend all of this time and money and effort, and we got to call the vet out. We're doing all of that stuff, and not banging on veterinarians. I'm just saying, like,
no, but
let's just not prevent. Let's just not produce this type of feed and then feed it to cows.
Right.
So then what's our other option? Well, we send somebody to go pitch it off. Well, that's a safety issue, right? Somebody's climbing on top of this pile, particularly when it's snowing but in any time, you know, falling from height is a big risk that we have on farms that we don't have to produce. That was a management decision that caused that to happen, mm-hmm. right? We chose not to use the best technology. We chose not to do the best management practices. So now I'm sending a person up there to deal with it. When we know that the solution financially pays for the results, why do we have to do that? But we got a risk there. We've got a labor issue. Now what do we got to do? We got to put it in some sort of vehicle and haul it back away and dump it back in the field. It's always been asked to me. I don't know the answer, but it seems logical. It's like, well, aren't we just re-inoculating our fields with all of these spoilage organisms, and they're going to get on our crops, and we're going to bring them back into the silo next year? Yeah, possibly. I mean, nobody knows for sure, but to me, it's kind of logical. It could be, right? All I know is if I don't do it, then I don't have to worry about that. So shutting that off at the front, there's nothing good about it. Nope. And the other thing I've told people is like, look, if we don't know how to fix it, or we don't have the technology how to fix it, then it's okay to do it. We've known for 20 years or more how to have aerobically stable feeds. We've known for, oh gosh, it's pushing 20 years too, that we've had oxygen barrier materials,
yes,
at least 15 years, right? That we've had these. There's a lot of really good products out there. There's also some that aren't so good.
Right.
So we need to be aware of those things too. And these companies should be able to provide you with independent tests. And we call it in the industry, we call it an oxygen transmission rate test. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have a standardized oxygen transmission rate test, and it looks like it came out of Joey Joe's garage and he tested it, it's probably not what you think it is. And of course, anytime somebody says, I got the same thing, only cheaper, well, then you better verify.
Right. And the other
you better
thing
do
about
a lot
tests.
Of verification.
Yeah, the other thing about tests is, where did that test come from? Some garage lab, but also, did it come out of the manufacturer who made that plastic?
Mm-hmm.
That's always a question.
So. Yeah, yeah. So I think in a lot of cases, it's, you know, trust but verify, right?
Yeah.
And is there third party information, third party laboratories?
Yeah.
There's some universities and a few really good places to get things done.
Yeah.
But if they're doing it themselves, then you kind of need to question things.
Excellent.
And then of course, you know, I always say, you know, all these tests and all these lab results and everything are fine. I always ask, what do cows say? And dead cows don't make milk, right?
No.
So it's pretty easy to tell if what we're doing is working. And then of course, our friends and neighbors and trusted people that we've all got in the business, like, well, they're using this product. Let me go over there and look and see.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, you know, I got more surface spoilage than they do. Maybe that product really is working.
Mm-hmm.
And because some of this stuff is pretty darn obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen piles that you drive by at 70 miles an hour. Like, you can see the surface spoilage from a quarter mile away. It's like, I know he's not using. I know he's got surface spoilage issues. I know he's got health issues. I know he's got shrink loss issues. I know he's got plastic issues. I mean, it's amazing. As much as I've done this, and as long as I've done it, you can see a lot of things before you even get there. But see, round pile, like, because I'm a big fan of drive over piles, but I'm a really big fan of angular, and you know, a 3-to-1 or 1-to-3, or at least correct way to say it, slope, but a good flat. We get these rounded piles. Rounded piles are usually rotten.
Right. Oh, yeah. Because they,
don't have good densities. Yeah. Or you see, I call it the motion of the ocean, but you see these piles that have the waves in them, or, you know, the driving just up the sides.
Oh, you know.
It's kind of like, I guess a dairyman like it because it looks like a herringbone parlor, you know, when they come up both. But the, you know, when you can see the tire tracks in it, you just automatically know it's low dense, high shrink, high risk. Even if they're using a barrier, they're not going to get the maximum benefit out of it as if the packing density was right. There's still going to be some spoilage in there. It's not going to be as great as if they didn't use a barrier. Imagine if they didn't use a barrier. It could be a, you know, a big black rotten crust. But I've had people say, oh, it's only like 3 inches of crust. Well, that feed was probably 6 to 9 inches to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And the stuff that's 18 inches underneath that is very much compromised nutrition.
Yeah. And until you've done exactly, and until you've dug in it yourself and actually sampled that, which I have done, and obviously you've done too, you know, they think, oh, I just pitch off that 3 inches and I'm good. It is amazing how deep this goes. And it really goes down about 3 feet or a meter for anybody in Canada. Like, you know, it's really that whole top. And then you go, okay, well, how big is this pile? And then this 3 foot, like watermelon rind, if you will, that's all the way around it. I want a thin rind. I don't want a big rind. Right. And the truth is, I don't want to make any rind at all.
Right.
And we know how to do that. And that starts with good compaction, a good game plan, everything that we've already talked to, using good products, and sealing it up with good materials. It's absolutely critical.
Man, we've covered a lot of ground.
Did we?
A lot that goes.
I yapped a lot. I don't know if we covered any ground, but.
Oh, I think we covered some ground. And I think that I appreciate the ideas that you gave to our listeners, that maybe they can kind of scratch their heads and go, hey, I never thought about that. Like the extra bunker to put that feed in and that kind of stuff. So
A time to make a drive over pile, right? It doesn't really cost me a whole lot. I don't need to invest in a storage structure. It's not permanent. Right? The other thing, let me mention real quickly on drive over piles. I know I'm taking too much time, but one thing I love about a drive over pile is if they're done correctly, and this is the if, especially if you've never done them before, is we should build them with a game plan where that face matches how many tons that we want to take out of that every single day based on the number of cows and what ration we're going to put in there. We don't build a drive over pile just because we didn't have walls and we don't need to make it this big massive round mound or something like that just because that's what the floor space does. The true way to do a drive over pile is to build it based on how we want to feed the feed that we're going to have. Now that's what I spend a lot of time helping people with, and develop some, you know, spreadsheet calculator things to do that with, and actually design a shape of a pile based on feeding rates, densities, dry matters, all of those things. That's the power of a drive over pile. So maybe that's a flex, you know, situation for us too, is okay, I want to feed through this potentially wet butyric grass. I want to make that thing like an ag bag. I don't have a bagger, but I can make a drive over pile look like an ag bag, make it long and skinny and just blow through it real fast.
Right.
Now I've got a very, very small face exposed to oxygen. Why would I make that thing super wide? Just because that's like cutting the bunk down the long side of it too. Right. Mm-hmm. So you know, all of these faces, the smaller we can make them, whether it's a bunker or a drive over pile or a bag, like a bag has a small face. It's one of the reasons bags are very successful.
Basically how to plan out what you have to think about before you even start. And one of the things that I appreciate too, that you mentioned, feed centers, of course, and working with a local agronomist to figure out some varieties that are going to work for you and some planting dates that can help you out, and paying attention to what these people that are talking about weather are giving us, the information they're giving us.
I think it's a team approach, you know, making sure that everybody on the farm and everybody's involved in this, you know, understands this. So there has to be a coach. Right. And there are certain leaders and everybody needs to know their roles. And that is bringing in also probably your nutrition consultant, the farm owners, and, you know, everybody involved in this, you know, when possible. A lot of people in the West, we use custom harvesters to come in. Maybe we need to have that.
Yeah.
We have a custom covering company that comes in and stuff. And so are they all aware of what our game plan is before it happens, instead of just saying, oh, we got a pile, I need you guys to come covered on Tuesday. Maybe they can't be there on Tuesday, right? Because they have another commitment. If they'd have known ahead of time and how we want to handle this thing. So it's like, I don't think we can over plan enough, but we can certainly under plan. And I think something else too that helps with the game planning, and then I will stop, is when we have issues, and everybody's going to, and it's unavoidable, let's don't blame anybody or whatever, but let's record what they were, because they're learning lessons for next time. Because a lot of times I like to coach people that as soon as we're done, let's have a sit down, even though everybody wants to be done, where it's just, you know, we covered and now we could take a deep breath, right? But it's like, let's take one more step and let's review the good, the bad, and the ugly of what happened. We don't have to cuss and discuss it. We just need to get it recorded. And then we can use that as our opening statement, game plan, when we go back into planning next year. Because if we wait another 3 or 4 or 6 months or whatever that looks like, we can forget a lot of those things.
Oh, you'll forget it within a week.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Yeah, right.
We got to get it out of here. Got to get it out of our mind.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric, for joining us. And we've had Eric
thanks for
Dorr
having me
today. Yeah, Eric Dorr from Stillwater Animal Technologies in Nampa, Idaho. And your website again?
SilageMatters.com. Or directly, my email is edorridaho@gmail.com. First initial, last name, idaho@gmail.com. When I was in New York a couple of weeks, I told Andrew at Papa's Dairy in Malone, New York, that I was going to be on a podcast, and he said he'd listen. So
all right,
told him I'd give him a shout out, because we were looking at stuff, and we're looking at putting drive-over piles up there in New York, because he's outgrown his feed center. He's building a brand new, beautiful, automated, fully automated parlor. And as soon as he's done with that, we're working on a new feed center up there, and it's going to be based around drive-over piles. So anyway, thanks, Andrew.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. You've been listening to the Dairy Voice podcast by Dairy Business News, and I'm your host, Connie Kuber, with Seal Pro Silage Barrier Film by Connor Agerscience. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again soon.